Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for April 28th, 2008, and on this episode we have an interview with Remy Bumpo Think Theater's artistic director, James Bonin. He'll be talking to Tom Williams about their show, Bronte, that is now playing. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, and thank you for listening. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is one of the men in this town who I respect the most as a director and an artistic director. His name is James Bonin, and he is the director for Remy Bumpo Think Theater and the artistic director who has Bronte going now and a companion piece. Hello, James.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Tell me about Bronte, because I think it was a terrific production.
Thank you very much. It's written by a woman named Polly Teal, who runs a company called Shared Experience in London. They build plays somewhat improvisationally. They adapt a lot of books. She did an adaptation 10 years ago of Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. And she got, I think, fascinated, as I can't imagine anybody not getting fascinated by the Bronte family once you start to engage with them, because they were... They were so mysterious that they would create all this work that they did based on really just their imaginations, because they lived this very Spartan life in West Yorkshire in the 1840s and 1830s when, you know, traveling was difficult. Charlotte married at the very end of her life. None of the other brothers or sisters ever married. There was just, then the play tries to kind of, I think the play is asking a central question of how does a writer create a work of true genius? You know, what is it? How do you take these simple elements from your personal life that's so austere and somehow blossom them into books that people will read, you know, as long as people are reading?
Yeah, where do they get the information? Because you're right, they were almost the poster child for dysfunctional families of the era, plus the role of women in the 1830s and 40s.
Women
couldn't do much.
No, with Victorian women, in the early part of the Victorian era, women had very, very limited lives. And if you had no money, as the Brontes had no money at all, then that just restricted your lives even more. And they, in their own town, they were a bit of a freakish combination, because they had no money, but they were, because of their father, who was the pastor, a curate, they were very well educated.
Women didn't go to school later, but the father believed in reading and books and just kept funneling classics.
Gave them every classic piece of literature. They all spoke and read Greek and Latin. I mean, they were just remarkable for kids. And of course, they'd grown up with terrible tragedy. The two oldest girls in the family died when they were 12 years old and 11 from tuberculosis. And that's actually consumption, which killed three of the other four. Anne Bronte, Emily Bronte, and their brother Branwell all died within 10 months of each other of consumption when they were around 30. So it's a family just stacked with tragedy. I mean, just, it's unbearable.
And in that era, right, the only way a woman really made anything of herself was to get married off to a better status.
That was the only way to jump a class or two was to, but of course, because they had no money, they had no dowry, and none of them were particularly attractive.
Yeah, they were kind of plain women.
And they were tiny. All of them were tiny. And so they had each other. And they had their brother Branwell, who had a very difficult, complicated life. He had drug addiction problems and alcohol problems, and he had a catastrophic affair that I think contributed. And the play really deals with this in a very interesting way. But I think that affair in 1845 contributed to the males of all three women's novels.
So you think a lot of the information they got, besides their imagination and stories they heard were from the brother, because he was quite an adventurous character.
He was adventurous in both good and bad ways, and happy and very, very sad ways, I think. He's kind of the tragic figure.
Yeah, I think so. All right. Yeah. Tell us what got you interested enough to mount this play.
Wow. Well, I had seen a play of Polly Teal's a couple of years ago in London called After Mrs. Rochester, which is actually about the Bertha Rochester and Jane Eyre, the first wife, the mad woman who lives in the attic. And it was about Jean Rees, who wrote a book called Wide Sargasso Sea about Bertha Mason before she became Mrs. Rochester.
Okay.
And so the play, I was just fascinated with the way the play was like a Picasso painting in a way. I mean, it tried to tell three or four stories simultaneously, and it moved around in time. And it just really made me kind of fascinated by the process. I was hungry for that information. And when I found out that she'd created a play about the Bronte family, and I read it, and the very first time I read it, I thought, oh, my God, we just have to do this play. It's just so unusual. It was unlike a lot of things we do, because we tend to do plays that are usually pretty linear. And so I was challenged by that hugely. But then the more that I read about the Brontes and reread the books, you just fall in love with them, because you have such – they had such kind of remarkable strength and bravery, and yet – and they were tremendously compassionate with each other, and yet they had that very much that Yorkshire kind of character of being tough and flinty as well. So it's almost like, in a way, it's a little bit like some of the characters in the Thornton Wilder might paint from Our Town, that kind
of
New England toughness and unsentimental.
Yeah, and it came off in your production. What I thought was amazing was the way you were able to jump back and forth in time. Now, at the beginning, it was, you had to tune into it. But you also have to tune into Shakespeare.
Right.
But
right.
The payoff is there. As I said in my reel to people, just bear with it and tune in. You'll get it, because you go back and forth in time, and then you have some of the characters from the novel sort of intervene.
Right.
Tell us about it. I thought it was fascinating.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it so much. The first act in particular is very challenging for the audience. I agree with you, because it starts with the three actresses who are playing the sisters come on as the actresses and give you a kind of background about the family and the sisters. And then about halfway through that section, they start speaking in a Yorkshire dialect.
Yeah.
And then so you realize they've just become the sisters in front of your eyes. And then, yes, the play, the sort of main thrust of the story takes place on one night in 1845. But the first act, you also see them when they're 7, 8, 9, and 10. You see them as teenagers. You see them as in their 20s. So that, the play really does challenge you. Oh, yes. And, of course, as you said, there's Bertha Mason and Catherine Earnshaw. Catherine Earnshaw from Wuthering Heights and Bertha Mason from Jane Eyre are in the first act. In the second act, Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights appears and Mr. Rochester from Jane Eyre. So it's a very layered play, but it's like, I think Shakespeare's a good example, or Tom Stoppard, where they have a lot of faith that the audience will pay attention, and if you're patient, you do get the payoffs, because it all starts to coalesce and you begin to see, oh, I see how that works, and that's why I needed to know that, and
well, I think it lives up to that Think Theater name that you guys have, which is valid, because everything doesn't, I don't like to go every night to theater and where I'm spoon-fed.
Right.
I want to be challenged, and I think audiences appreciate that.
Well, I hope so. And I do think that's something we believe in. And it's not that we don't do a lot of funny plays, but we do plays that as I always say, it's the sort of play we want to do, plays that you wake up the next morning and you're still kind of pondering them, whether good or bad, funny or sad, but that it affects your life in a way that you can take it home. And it becomes a part of your experience for the next few days, just sort of, pondering what you've seen.
Well, tell us about the casting of the show, because I know some of the ladies that are in the show are also in the follow-up show, which we'll talk about.
Right.
And you're particularly challenged as a director to do a complicated piece where you're telling quite an amazing story.
Yeah, I think the hardest, the actresses, the three actors playing the sisters, all of whom I've worked with before, but two of them with Remy Bumpo. Susan Shunk plays Charlotte, and Carrie Coon plays Emily, and Rachel Sondag plays Anne. And Anne's kind of the unsung sister, but she's really quite an impressive and socially conscious woman. And she really, even more than the other two, wrote about women's issues in that part of the century. Yeah, in her two novels. But the women, and then Greg Anderson plays the brother and Heathcliff, and Patrick Clear plays the father, and Patrick and I have worked together a number of times, and then Linda Gillam, one of my closest friends, plays both Bertha Rochester and Catherine Earnshaw.
She should get a special... I mean, it's kind of a thankless role
because as an actress, she's not really creating characters. She's reflecting what's in the mind of two other characters on stage.
And all those costume changes.
Oh, my God. She must have 15 quick changes in the play. I mean, it drove her nearly mad, but she's done great work in the parts. One of the real pleasures of this play was the fact that everybody knew each other, and then they'd done a lot of research on the Brontes, so they loved the family, and so the rehearsal process became a real, very very enjoyable and challenging piece, because it's very hard to keep consistent and clear when the play keeps jumping around in time, and you have fictional characters. And we worked and worked and worked on that.
Well, it came off, because I can tell you, other than seeing Jane Eyre the musical, I've not read other books. You know, when I went to Boys Catholic High School, we didn't read Wuthering Heights or Jane Eyre.
I understand.
But I really got a feel for it, and I got really interested. And afterward, one of my things is, you know, thank God for Google. I mean, I was all over reading about these sisters.
Right.
And I think the portrait you painted and that your characters brought to life seemed to be very accurate from the research I did.
Oh, well, great. Yeah, I think Polly Teal did a masterful job of, you know, taking events and showing how particular events led to a much bigger consequence, both good and bad, for the family.
Yeah, and I thought Gregory Anderson was terrific. That's the best thing. He's really growing as an actor.
No,
yeah,
it's really exciting to watch him grow up. I mean, he's got limitless possibilities, I think.
Well, the show is still running. We'll be running through May 4th. And what days you run?
We run Wednesdays through Sundays.
Wednesdays through Sundays at the Victory Gardens Greenhouse, the upstairs theater.
7:30 in the evening and 2:30 on Sunday afternoons.
Okay. Make sure you get to see the show, because it's a unique piece of theater, and it's one that, especially if you have ever read any of the books, you've got to see this. And if you haven't, it'll get you interested.
Yeah, that's the thing. It really piques your interest in that.
And you were telling me before we went on the air that you had... high school students there today for some special math.
Yes,
Tell us about that, because I am such a fan of that, and I really respect you guys when you do that.
Well, we're trying to do more and more of it, and we sometimes do plays that high school teachers are a little nervous about bringing their students to. But I think this one in particular, we really tried to. We scheduled, I think, with four high school matinees, and they've really been well attended, and the kids, I think, are appreciative. And we have a talk back for them, and they get study guides. And we had a half an hour talk back today, and then the kids asked really intelligent questions, and it was lots of fun. And I agree with you. I mean, I wish we had the funding to do it all the time.
Yeah,
because it's,
corporate America, this is a project for the top theater groups to do when they do terrific plays, to help subsidize so we can do more matinees.
Yeah, no, I really believe in that, too.
I do, too.
Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, I wanted, because I appreciate that. And the kids were really into it, huh?
Yeah, no, they were, yeah. I mean, you know, some of the guys, some of the boys, you have to be high school kids, you know, so they're sort of feigned like they're bored.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember being a high school kid and doing that. But afterwards, you could just tell by the questions they asked that they'd really... got carried along by the story.
The questions, it's all in that.
Give themselves away when they
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, now you have a new piece, On the Verge, that's opening on the 15th of May, and some of the literature I read about says it's a companion piece to Bronte. So tell us about it, because I haven't got a clue how it could be.
Well, it's a companion piece in a couple of ways.
Okay.
Not directly, but the first thing you should know is that three of the four Bronte children play three of the four characters in On the Verge. Susan Shunk and Carrie Coon Susan Shunk, Rachel Sondag, and Greg Anderson. But And On the Verge is a play that I first encountered in the 80s, in the late 80s. It's written by Eric Overmyer, and it involves three late Victorian women. And now, so we're talking 40 years after the Bronte sisters.
So it would be like 1880s.
The play begins in 1888.
Okay.
And this has gotten more attention over the years, but there were a great number of Victorian women who had time on their hands and some money, neither of which the Brontes had, by the way.
That's true.
But they could travel, and they traveled all over the world, frequently on their own. I mean, some of the stories of these women travelers are, it's absolutely mind-boggling.
It's tough to travel alone today.
Well, I know. I don't mean by alone. I mean, they were always accompanied by porters or Sherpas, but I mean that the women traveled without male companionship. They frequently had to pretend to be males. There was one woman who lived in Lhasa in Tibet for a year and a half dressed as a man and apprenticed herself to various, you know, shaman. And their stories are phenomenal. And what Eric Overmyer did, who now writes for television, alas, he doesn't write many plays any longer, but he read a huge amount about all these various Victorian women and then took three women, created three American Victorian women travelers, and sent them, they don't know this when the play starts, but they're traveling through time.
Oh, interesting.
And they end up landing in 1955. And along the way, they meet various male characters, all played by Greg Anderson. So Greg plays eight different.
Well, you're working him to death.
Yeah, it's good for him.
Good
for him.
Sure.
But I find this play to be both empowering. It's hilariously funny. It's just in love with language. I mean, the language is remarkably skillfully used. It'll make you laugh out loud. It's moving sometimes, but never in a way that makes, like the Brontes, you know, the Bronte play is very, very moving because, you know, three of the characters die, you know, over
true.
The course of the play.
And all young. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of them quite young, which is just tragic. But On the Verge, you just see the sort of the opposite end of the Victorian era when, you know, right when Shaw started writing plays and women really could see a different life for themselves and a more powerful life. And these women are inspirational and they're smart as whips and brave and hilarious.
So they're not aware and they start off going on a trip.
And they keep getting these kind of odd images. They find an I Like Ike button.
Oh.
And they find a clipping from with a picture of Richard Nixon. And they try to, and they says president. And they say, president of what? And then they realize, and that clipping's from the New York Times, so it has credence for them. But it also has the dates 1953 and 1972. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. I mean, how could that be? Printer's errors? And then eventually they come through a portal in time into 1955, and then two of them decide that life couldn't be any better than 1955, and they decide to stay. One to go on to a career of songwriting, and the other, I'll keep that as a surprise.
Okay.
And then another character ends up traveling on into, you know, for deeper into time. And I did this play in Aspen in our summer tent many years ago, and I've always loved the play. And when we chose Bronte, I thought, oh my God, you could just take the same people and show the other end of the Victorian era.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that segue working.
Yeah, yeah. So that I think the plays comment on each other in a way, in ways that are subtle, but I think really very meaningful.
So this one's a comedy.
This one's absolutely a comedy.
But it's a smart comedy.
Smart?
Because I noticed one of the things that seems to attract you and your company is smart scripts.
Yeah, and I don't mean smart like in egghead scripts, but scripts that do use language in really rich
terrific
ways.
Yeah,
you know, and we're all drawn to that for whatever reason, probably because we're all old people. But you know, it just we do really respond strongly to scripts like that. We love writers like Shaw and Stoppard, who just challenge you but always entertain you. I mean, their language is rigorous, but it's also heartfelt, and they know how to argue. See, I'm a big believer in arguing, and I don't mean arguing yelling. I just mean a kind of mental engagement.
Engagement of ideas, yeah.
Yeah, so that...
Well, that seems to be a trademark of a lot of the shows that you've done.
Yeah. I think that's right.
So this fits that mold, but it also has
it does,
comedy.
But it's hugely silly. Okay. I mean, you know, there's an abominable snowman and a cannibal, and there's all sorts of... Mr. Coffee is on stage for a while.
Oh, Mr. Coffee.
Yes, we all know how important he is. You know, it's just a ridiculously fun script. So,
well, I can't wait to see,
That. That just runs 3 weeks, so okay. It's only 18 performances. Get your tickets now.
Yeah, it opens on the 15th.
RemyBumpo.org.
Okay. And it's at the Victory Gardens Greenhouse,
same place.
Upstairs.
Yeah, and the set will look very similar, actually. Okay. I mean, without the Bronte's books on the and no table, obviously. So.
Well, that sounds...
And they do... Oh, the other thing about it that I should mention is that like the Bronte's, it's a play about imagination in the sense that you'll see these women climb a rock face and be in a blizzard and walking through swamps and on a suspension bridge, you know, a plank. Mm-hmm. And none of that is visible. It's all done through just physical activity.
Well, that's one of the things I love about theater is it is about imagination.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you...
And years from now, you'll have people say, how did you do that drawbridge?
Right.
Just like I always tell that story about Marriott or when they did Miss Saigon, Terry James tells a story. People say, man, how you got that helicopter on the stage? There was no helicopter. Yeah, it was all sound.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
It really is one of the things that's so, so special about theater, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and you guys do that.
Yeah.
We try. And I like your sets, too.
Oh, thanks.
That depending on the show, and you always make your sets... Thank God, so there, you don't have to have a blackout every minute or so. That just drives me up the wall.
Yeah, no, I really believe that and I believe this too with actors. When we work in rehearsal, we really try to take... Well, Stoppard has a great joke in The Real Thing where he says the difference between theater and real life is thinking time.
I
really think that's true.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't ever want there to be dead air on the stage unless there's a reason that someone has to stop to think of a response. Otherwise, you're just ready to go and you talk. And I think that's also true of our set changes and things. We really try to move things forward. Now, you know, some people got, there was a lot of critical response about the Brontes about the way the play moved around, and there were so many scenes, and, you know, but I think we at least kept the action moving all the time.
Yeah, it did it with style.
Yeah, I mean, like it or not like it, that's out of our control. But
well, you had to tell a story,
you're telling
an epic story.
Right. So I think, you know, I was proud of the fact that we at least kept people... You know, the story always moves forward, and I think that is something we really try to... We're consciously aware of that.
Yeah, because that's one of the influences of today's theater goer from film and television.
Right.
That you just got to keep it rolling.
Yeah.
And I think that's legitimate.
I do too.
I think it's a challenge to the directors to do, you know, to make it work.
Right. Well, and I mean, a good example, to go back to Shakespeare, I mean, you know, if you read what people write about Shakespeare's plays back when they were doing them, the plays were much, much quicker than they are now. You know, even the long plays were done probably in two-thirds the time that...
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. No. I mean, just people spoke faster, but there weren't set changes. And there weren't, you know, they just didn't do that.
No.
And that's why Shakespeare... wrote the way he wrote, is that the language tells you where you are all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
The language sets the scene.
Yeah.
And then he was so brilliant at creating characters that holds you in the story. And the story just roars. You know, it just goes.
So this is a comedy for you guys.
Absolutely. And, yeah, it's really a life-giving comedy in ways that I think, you know, the women, you just fall in love with these women because they're, you know, you see all the sort of physical hardships they go through, and then they tell you all these stories of their own events. I mean, there's a great There's a character, the youngest of the three women in the play is named Alex, Alexander Kerfuffle. And she, but she tells stories. She's the one who spent most time in the Himalayas. And she tells these stories of things that she's witnessed that you just know that if someone told you that story and they hadn't been there, you'd think, well, there's no way that could happen. And so it's so much about the sort of potency of travel and the sense of really allowing yourself to be just a little brave. And if you just are a little brave, then anything can happen. You know, if you can just get yourself out of the house, who knows what might happen to you?
That's a great message. Yeah.
Well, and here's the other thing. The last thing I'll say about it is the subtitle of the play is The Geography of Yearning. And
Geography of Yearning.
I have almost never come across a more apt idea for life and for just the sense of, I mean, when we stop yearning for things, whatever they are, you know, that's a very dangerous moment of your life. And I think,
life starts ending.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think I think the play will entertain people hugely, but the sort of subtle message underneath it is, let's go, let's go and explore and learn and absorb and be changed by what we experience.
So it's On the Verge.
On the Verge.
And it opens on the 15th for a three-week run.
3 weeks only. 3 weeks. So that's only 18 performances.
Okay. So I have to ask you, Remy Bumpo. You are one of the founders of from 1976.
No. 96.
Yeah. I'm sorry. 96.
I'm not quite that old.
Okay. How did you come up with that name?
Oh, gosh. The name has been both the joy and the bane of our existence. I had two friends in Aspen. I used to run a summer equity theater in Aspen with two friends and we worked in a tent. Eventually, we worked in an upscale tent, but we started out in a very spare tent. But we decided we would leave Aspen and find the last best place in the country to start a small to medium-sized regional theater. And we'd go and spend weeks various places, Asheville, North Carolina, and Burlington, Vermont, Eugene, Oregon. And we never quite found the right mix, or the town wasn't ready for what we wanted to do. And I had an apartment here, and I had just started working at American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin. And so we thought, well, while we're still looking, why don't we do one play here?
Uh-oh.
Ta-da, 12 years later. But so we chose Tom Stoppard's Night and Day. And then Victory Gardens had a second slot open up right after that. And they said, do you want to do a second play? And we kind of looked at each other and we thought, well, yeah, it might be easier to sell a little mini season. So we decided to do Chekhov's The Seagull. But then, of course, this is the point of the story. This publicist said, well, you've got to have a name. And we had no intention of staying in Chicago. So we weren't going to, pick a real name. So we just, we created a production company which had the name of my Labrador at that point was named Natty Bumpo from The Last of the Mohicans, and my partner's cat was named Remy Martin from the Cognac. So we put the two names together. So the theater was named for a cat and a dog, both long departed now, alas. But it was never really intended to be a public name at all.
But now it's so unique.
I know.
Yeah.
And, people have made jokes about it over the years, including some well-known but unnamed critics who've always been after me to change the name. But, I think
it's... really?
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody said it sounds like a clown company. And I said, and what's the problem with sounding like a clown?
Yeah, right.
But it is. But that did lead to the Think Theater idea. Because at a certain point, once we became a not-for-profit and got a board, and, there was a lot of people said, if you want to make it more specific, keep the name, but help people to know what it is you do.
I think that was terrific to add that.
Yeah, that was...
When I first noticed it after seeing several of your plays, I go, that's an apt description.
Yeah, my wonderful friend Robert Petrick thought it up one day. He just called me up. And then the thing I like about it is that it's either says Think Theater or... Think Theater, there's okay. There's a little bit of funniness about it, and yet it really does identify what we hope to do. And again, I want to always emphasize, Think Theater is not pedantic theater. It's energized, exciting, you know, kind of verbally dexterous theater.
Let me add, well-produced and well-acted.
Thank you.
You're an equity company, and your stable of actors are phenomenal.
We've been very lucky in that way, Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, now, I understand that you're still involved with the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I love it up there. In fact, I finally bought a house up there. I mean, this will be my 12th season, and I'm doing Henry IV this summer. It's a great, great place.
You know, I've never been there, but I'm going to make it.
Yeah, you really
should. I've got to come up and see that now.
Yeah, it's just, it's an 1,150-seat outdoor theater on a hill. It's the second most heavily attended outdoor theater in the country.
Is that right?
Yeah. But
I know Chris Jones goes all area. He always speaks highly of it.
Yeah, Chris has come up the last 5 or 6 years, and that's been really helpful. They're still building a Chicago audience, but, you know, it's 3 hours from Chicago.
That's not bad.
No, and the nice thing is, you know, it's a big acting company, and over the course of, starting in early August, if you come up on a Thursday to a Monday morning, you can see 5 different plays.
Well, you're talking to a junkie like me, that's perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. The first half of the season, 3 plays run and rep, and then we add 2 more in the second half of the season. And then it runs until the first weekend of October. And it can get a little chilly in October, but it's remarkably, I think the acting company is very, very strong. It's about a 16 or 17 equity members, permanent company, and then we have a bunch of non-ex, and then it's some wonderful interns every year who keep rotating in and out.
You had the one-person show down. Tell us about that came down to Chicago.
Right. My friend Jimmy DeVito wrote a wonderful play based on Dickens's last tour of America. It's called Dickens in America. And, we did it for Jim Ridge, one of the company members up there, and Jimmy's a company member as well, performed it for us for 3 nights last December.
It was fabulous.
December.
Yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed it.
It was fun, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, APT has just broken ground on an indoor theater. And so we have plans, I hope, over that once that gets in running, that, you know, that we can do joint productions between the two.
Or
companies.
Take one show and move it back and
move
forth.
Move it back and forth.
Boy, that would be terrific.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. It'll probably be 2 years from now to begin with.
Okay. So. In the last few moments we have, you had a career before being a artistic director, right? You were a high school teacher?
Yeah, yes.
Tell us about that.
I've had many careers. But I spent my 20s in a wonderful program in Colorado Springs working with high school dropouts. So, my dog is going to be sick over in the corner there. That's going to be attractive.
Ew. He didn't like the food you gave him.
Right, exactly. But no, I spent, I just really started out in life to be a history and English teacher, and all the teaching was done one-to-one. It was just I loved that job, absolutely loved it. And then slowly I kind of got seduced by the theater. Sorry about that.
Yeah, okay.
But even then I didn't really, you know, it still took me 10 more years to, once I got a master's in directing, to really start directing. So in the interim, I ended up owning a movie theater in Connecticut for a while, an art theater. So
wow.
Yeah. So it's been...
Well, you're an example of you keep following your dream.
Yeah.
And eventually, once you find what your place is.
I feel really lucky now. I feel like I've found a way to contribute to the community.
Okay. Last question.
Okay.
Would be what are some of the plays, or what are your plans for the future? What are some of the plays you'd like to do?
Oh, gosh. Wow. Oh. Well, we'd like to continue to do the kinds of plays we do, and also try to get a little more classical work, and oddly enough, more contemporary. I mean, plays that are written right now, and maybe new adaptations, things like that.
Okay.
That were.
Is there one that comes to mind that you'd really love to do?
Well, there's some. I mean, one of the plays that and it's not a new play at all, but there, one of the plays that I've always loved, I would love to find a way to do David Hare's version of Galileo, which I just adore. In fact, we're hoping to do a reading of it for the Humanities Festival in the fall.
Great. Great.
To sort of explore the possibility. Well, but there's many, many others. The list is long.
Thank you for the contribution in Chicago, because you've given many of us some great nights of theater. And Remy Bumko is one of the top
theater companies.
Thank you so much.
Folks, make sure you get to see Bromte and then get on, see the On the Verge. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, I think it'll tickle you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And folks, go see a play this week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of April 28th, 2008. Pegasus Players have announced their 30th anniversary 2008-2009 season, which will feature two Chicago premieres. Their 30th anniversary in season includes the politically charged Continental Divide that opens on October 6th. The run of this production corresponds with one of our country's biggest presidential elections. Remember, that starts this fall on October 6th. The 23rd annual Young Playwrights Festival comes back into town on January 12th. And The Shape of a Girl can be seen on March 2nd. This show will be enjoying its Chicago premiere. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum lights up May 4th of next year. This opening will mark Pegasus Players' 16th Stephen Sondheim production, and that's more than any other theater in the United States. Season subscription tickets are available. For more information, visit pegasusplayers.org or find their profile on our website, Theater in Chicago. Steppenwolf Theater Company has announced the lineup for First Look Repertory of New Work. This will be the fourth annual program featuring three productions of new developmental plays presented in rotation and accompanied by readings, lectures, and one-of-a-kind events. First Look Repertory of New Work runs July 23rd through August 10th. The 2008 productions included are Pursued by Happiness. This has been written by Keith Huff and can be seen on Wednesday, July 23rd, opening the program. Keith Huff, a playwright with the Chicago Dramatist, is the author of A Steady Rain, which is currently running at the Royal George Theater. The Perfect Mendacity, a plot-twisting tale by Jason Wells, can be seen on Thursday, July 24th. And Fair Use, a romantic comedy by Sarah Gibbons, can be seen on Friday, July 25th. Steppenwolf has also announced the continuation of First Look 101, a three-month experience of the process leading up to the opening nights of the productions. First Look 101 starts May 19th, and the space is only limited to 101 members, so if you want to be a part of the program, you better act quick. Tickets for First Look Repertory of New Work and First Look 101 go on sale to the general public Monday, May 5th at 11 a.m. For more information, stay tuned right here to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Profiles Theater has announced the extension of In a Dark, Dark House, the final play of their season devoted to the works of Neil LaBute. This will be the Midwest premiere of In a Dark, Dark House, and it marks only the second time the play has ever been produced. The show has been extended for an additional 5 weeks due to critical acclaim. It will now play through June 15th at the Profiles Theater. To get tickets for In a Dark, Dark House, you can buy tickets online at profilestheater.org or check out our Now Playing section on theaterinchicago.com. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank James Bonin for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.